Hello, this is Marcia Clenard with the February 12th, 2019, Tuesday edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. We will start on the front page of the paper today, and the article is entitled, let me get down there, Wings Above Decatur. Let's go for a fly through well over a century of Decatur's aviation history. And it begins in 1910. Hess Park at what's now East Kenwood Avenue and North Martin Luther King Jr. Drive hosts early aviator Charles F. Willard in 1910, 7 years after the Wright brothers took flight at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. Then known as Downing Racetrack, the park was a stop on what was billed as the first downstate flight in Illinois. The visit by Willard, the fourth American to pilot an airplane aboard a Curtiss Model D-4, is recognized on a plaque at Decatur Airport. 1920. The first landing strip, Haskell Field, is at Jasper Street and Pershing Road. It operated from 1920 to 1925. Pilots also used Kick Field at Wicks Road and Main Street, which was plowed up in 1936. 1932. A 60-acre airport was built in 1932 on the northwest corner of Decatur, drawing a crowd of 3,000 people in the opening ceremony. The privately owned airfield had 2,500-foot runways and served Decatur through World War II for flight training. The Decatur Park District assumed control of that airport in 1943. 1944. A fire destroys 18 planes and numerous structures. The land was later leased to Hunter Moody, who at age 20 became the youngest licensed transport pilot in the United States in 1934. He renamed and operated it until 1954. 1946. The current Decatur Airport opens. It cost $2 million to build, funded by the federal government. Originally three runways, it now measures well over 2,000 acres. 1950. Parks Air Transport, Inc. starts commercial service, but is quickly replaced by Ozark Airlines, which stays until 1982. The current commercial carrier is Cape Air, which replaced Air Choice One in 2018. 1952, first jet plane lands at Decatur Airport. 1958, year of the Decatur Aero Club was formed. Housed in Hangar 104, it now has about 80 members and three aircraft. 1966, the Federal Aviation Administration Control Tower is built at a cost of $308,000. 1977, the Illinois Army National Guard opens a $1.8 million aviation support facility. 1984, President Ronald Reagan, born in Tampico, uses the airport as an election campaign backdrop. Other campaigns that have used the airport include Richard Nixon, Robert Dole, and George McGovern. 1992, Mikhail Gorbachev, former president of the Soviet Union, lands to visit Duane O. Andreas, head of Archer Daniels Midland Company, to learn about food technology. Andreas also flew Mother Teresa to Decatur in his corporate jet in 1989. 1995. The Crosswinds runway expansion is finished. United Express starts service to Chicago O'Hare International Airport. 1999. A U.S. Customs office opens, and a year later, a foreign trade zone is designated. Included in this article are a lot of photographs and various quotes. One quote is from President Ronald Reagan during that 1984 campaign stop. He said, "When I was growing up, and it wasn't too far from here, I never dreamed I'd be flying into Decatur aboard Air Force One. As a matter of fact, when I was growing up, there wasn't an Air Force One. And here are some numbers related to the Decatur Airport. $2 million cost in 1943 dollars for Decatur Park District to acquire 700 acres of land for the Decatur Municipal Airport. It had three runways 150 feet wide and 5,300 feet long with 2.5 miles of taxiways. 24,000 size in square feet of Decatur Airport Terminal Building, which houses the rental car operations, the Red Barn Kitchen restaurants, and offices. Six stories of Decatur Airport Control Tower. The structure was built in the 1960s and is operational from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Three runways at the Decatur Airport measuring 8,500 feet, 6,800 feet, and 5,300 feet. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection offices, Illinois National Guard, Army Aviation Support Facility, and a Decatur Fire Department station also are on the grounds. Then there are pictures of the Illinois National Guard members performing maintenance checks on Black Hawk helicopters. And that's a also on the front of the Herald and Review for the 12th of February, is an education article entitled Uncertainty, Part of the Career Script. Musical theater majors prepared for challenges that lie ahead. A career in the arts, no matter if it's music, dance, or visual arts, always bears one hallmark, uncertainty. That's why a passion for creating must be the starting point in choosing that career. And the knowledge that you might have to have a day job as well. Students at Millikan University who are majoring in musical theater have both. Shelby Barrows from Raleigh, North Carolina is a senior in musical theater major at Millikan and is planning to attend bar as a second job, which she said would allow her to audition for shows during the day. Musical theater has been part of my life forever, she said. It's something that makes me incredibly happy, and I couldn't see myself doing anything else. It's still that way today. She graduates in May and plans to move to Chicago to audition for shows. There's something about the art of musical theater that's like nothing else in the world, she said. I'm so glad I made the decision I did. She hopes to earn her Actors Equity card in Chicago, which requires registering as a candidate and working a minimum number of weeks in shows that meet Actors Equity criteria. If actors are cast in productions at Equity theaters, they earn points for each show they do toward membership. Once a member, performers can't accept jobs in non-equity shows, and there are tours that require performers to be members of the equity. I might find that being there, in Chicago, is where I want to stay, Barrows said. I'm also thinking about, at some point, possibly getting my master's in fine arts. These are just ideas that are roaming around in my head. She has her first professional audition in North Carolina this summer. It's an equity theater, so they will see equity members first, but also are auditioning non-equity actors. During winter break, Millikan offered the new musicals workshop for Millikan students and students from other colleges as well, which is usually a chance to work with up-and-coming writers who are developing new shows. This year, the students had a chance to learn about recording and also traveled to Disney World to learn about musical theater employment there. Disney offers a lot of opportunities for performance in its parks, and several of the students are now considering beginning their careers there, said Evan Long, a professor of musical theater, theater history, and repertory at Millikan. The new musicals workshop give students a chance to help develop a musical from the ground up. And this year, they worked with Michael Kooman and Chris Diamond from New York City. Most of their music was already written, and students sent demo recordings to them prior to the workshop, so the two men could determine which voices suited their songs before the recording studio training. Then, to make their experience so much like professional theater as possible, the men assigned the pieces to students only the day before the recording sessions. Though the students had to learn the pieces quickly and be ready to record them. They were about a minute long, and they were also solo songs, so they didn't have to worry about harmonies, and then the men coached them in the studio, Long said. They did multiple takes, and then they did something they called comping, which I was unfamiliar with, where they took the best part of each take and melded them all together into a final track. Millikan School of Music students handled the recording and mixing, so the hands-on experience wasn't limited to theater students, he said. Like Barrows, Delaney Schmidt, whose home is in Frankfurt, is a musical theater major but is deciding between starting at Disney or going to Chicago. She's a junior, so she still has some time to think it over, and she, too, realizes she might have to have a day job to make ends meet, at least at first. If you make it, it can be as flexible as you want it to be, Schmidt said. I'm interested in theme park work. I'm planning on going home and basing myself in Chicago, but I'm also very interested in the work that's in Orlando at Disney. There's also Universal Studio, theme park, and regional theater. She came to music theater a little later than is usual, she said, because she was in high school before the bug hit her. Bitter, I should say. She's been a dancer and singer most of her life, and there was a moment, she said, when a teacher asked her what she wanted to do with her life, and she realized it was musical theater. She was like, yeah, that's it, Schmidt said. I enjoy telling a story to an audience and sharing in the experience. Moving now to some local and state news, there seems to be a lot of crime news in today's paper. The first article on the front of the local and state news, rapist gets prison. Schleskely pleaded guilty to attacking girls. A 19-year-old man was sentenced to a total of 20 years in prison Monday for the repeated rape and sexual abuse of two Decatur girls younger than 13. In an emotional sentencing hearing punctuated by sobs and cries of outrage from family members, Taylor L. Schleskely pleaded guilty to the predatory criminal sexual assault of a child and one count of aggravated criminal sexual abuse. Macon County Circuit Court Judge Jeffrey Geisler sentenced Schleskely to 15 years on the predatory criminal sexual assault charge, a Class 10 felony, and to 5 years on the count of aggravated criminal sexual abuse, a Class 2 felony. The sentences were the maximum allowed under a 20-year sentence cap agreed to at a plea deal approved when Schleskely first admitted his guilt at a hearing December 21st. But nothing I do here today can take back what has already occurred, said the judge as he passed sentence. I am well aware of that. Defense attorney Scott Reuter called family members to testify who described Schleskely as having cognitive disabilities. They said he had been seeing a therapist and was immature for his age. Schleskely read a statement apologizing for what he had done and explaining that he wants to make it right, and said he yet hoped he would become a productive citizen. Roeder suggested a sentence of 10 to 12 years would be appropriate. Victim impact statements from the girl victims and their mothers were read to the court. One child told the judge, Tyler deserves a lifetime in prison for what he did. He knew what he was doing, and he knew it was wrong, and he did it anyway. The other child said, Your Honor, my life has been changed by this. He ruined my life. I don't love myself no more. I don't want to have friends no more. I used to be happy, and now I'm mad and sad. Over the objection of the defense, the judge allowed one of the girls' fathers to address the court. He said the court must show that The demons will be taken care of and they will serve time for their wrongdoings. Macon County Assistant State's Attorney Kate Kurtz argued for the maximum sentence. She said Seskely's cognitive issues did not affect his ability to know right from wrong, and the girls he harmed would carry the emotional damage for the rest of their lives. In addition to the prison sentence, Seskely was ordered to register as a sex offender for the rest of his life. After Geisler passed sentence, factions from the victims and the Seskely's families broke into a shouting confrontation in the courtroom and had to be physically separated by court security officers. They were kept apart and allowed to leave the building separately as they shouted threats and recriminations at each other. A sworn affidavit about the charges from Decatur Police Detective Eric Matthews described the victims as best friends who were assaulted together. One girl told police the abuse took place until a week before Seskely's arrest on July 27th. The abuse was discovered when the mother of one of the girls was checking through her daughter's cell phone and found disturbing Facebook Messenger conversations. Matthews said the content of the conversations led the mother to believe her child was being raped. The next article, also from the local and state section of the paper, office fight ends with probation. Richard J. Rush, the man accused of repeatedly punching an employee during a dispute at his Decatur workplace, was sentenced to 24 months probation Monday. Rush, 57, appeared in a Macon County Circuit Court and pleaded guilty to a single charge of aggravated battery, a Class 3 felony. Macon County State's Attorney Christina Mullison said the incident dated to 6:30 a.m. on the morning of November 3rd, as work assignments were being handed out at construction supplies firm Gedeki. A sworn affidavit from the Macon County Sheriff's Office said Rush, described as a driver, became upset he could not work with a particular fellow driver. The affidavit described him as punching the employee handing out the assignments in the head, knocking him to the ground. When he attempted to get up, Rush punched him on the left side of the face, causing him to fall again, said the affidavit, which also said Rush threatened to get a gun and kill the employee. Outlining the plea deal to the court, defense attorney Philip Tibbs was careful to point out that the man attacked by Rush was not his supervisor, even though he was handing out the assignments, but a fellow employee. As part of his sentence, Rush was also ordered to stay away from the victim and his former workplace, perform 100 hours of community service, and pay $250 to have his DNA indexed in an Illinois State Police crime database. Asked for comment after the hearing, Rush said, "I am happy with the sentence," and added he was glad he wasn't facing jail prison time. The maximum sentence for aggravated battery in a public place is 5 years in prison. He did not wish to comment further about the incident. Man pepper sprays son. Police accuse a Warrensburg man of spraying his adult son with pepper spray after becoming convinced his son was trying to grab a woman in a store. A sworn Decatur police affidavit said the incident happened Saturday night at a discount store in the 600 block of South Oakland Avenue. Police said they interviewed the 28-year-old son as his eyes were still burning and his nose streaming from the effects of the spray. His 50-year-old father was booked on a preliminary charge of committing domestic battery, while having a previous domestic battery conviction. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the state's attorney's office. Writing in the affidavit, police officer Christopher Scallon said the father was shopping in the store around 8 p.m. and his son was waiting outside in a car. When the son said he saw a woman he knows enter the store, he decided to go in and say hello. He stated he entered the store and said something similar to, "Hey, pretty girl," while lightly touching, grabbing the back of her elbow, Scollins said. He stated that his father then got in front of the girl and told him to go outside. The son told police he had a brief argument with his father, and as he was getting ready to walk out of the store, he was hit in the eyes with pepper spray. The father told Scanlon that he was only trying to protect the woman, but said the spray had gone off accidentally. Scanlon said he reviewed stored surveillance tapes of the incident and said the woman was smiling as she left the store and did not appear to be in any danger. The father is free after posting $5,000 bond with the condition he stay away from his son. Blaze puts firefighters to the test. All but one Decatur Fire Company responded to a Monday evening blaze that destroyed a multiple-story home on the city's west side, according to Fire Chief Jeff Abbott. Abbott said firefighters were called to the home in the 500 block of West Wood Street between 6 and 6:30 p.m. He could not provide the exact address of the house Monday night. When the fire crews arrived, Abbott said, heavy flames and smoke were seen coming from the front of the structure. The fire continued to spread throughout the house, which made it difficult for firefighters to extinguish from the inside, he said. Once they came toward the front, you could see fire behind them in the back, Abbott said. So you've got to put the fire out behind them before you can go further. It was like chasing our tail, basically, for the first hour. At 8:15 p.m., Abbott said ladder trucks had extinguished the main body of the fire, and crews were waiting to see if any hot spots would develop. No injuries reported at the scene, Abbott said, and no one was believed to have been inside at the time. He said fire crews were initially told the house was vacant, but Decatur police informed him that they made contact with the homeowner. Abbott said the house was considered a total loss. The cause of the fire was still under investigation Monday, he said. The intersection of Wood and Monroe Streets was closed as firefighters worked the fire. The Decatur Police Department and Decatur Ambulance Service also responded to the scene. And we're now going to move to the sports section for Tuesday, February 12th, Herald and Review. Mattoon won't play in the postseason. Scheduling error causes school to be ineligible. The Mattoon girls basketball team will not be playing in the postseason. A scheduling oversight caused the team to exceed the maximum number of regular season games allowed by the IHSA, the school said in a statement. The IHSA permits a maximum of 31 games to be played, but a December game that was a late addition bumped the regular season total to 32 games, triggering ineligibility for the postseason. Athletic Director David Veith said another school contacted Mattoon early in the season and asked to schedule a game against the Green Wave. Mattoon obliged, thinking it had room to accommodate another game. Veith called it an oversight. He declined to name the school. "We didn't think we were at that point," Veith said. "We made a mistake. It's a tough deal." Mattoon was scheduled to play Paris on Tuesday in the Class 3A Mount Zion Regional. Instead, Mount Zion, which was originally scheduled to play Monday against Eisenhower, will play Paris at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday, following MacArthur versus Eisenhower at 6 p.m. Mattoon finished with a 17-15 record and a 7-5 mark in the Apollo Conference. The Green Wave concluded its regular season and the postseason for the team. I misread that. The Green Wave concluded its regular season with a 55-38 win against Mount Zion on February 7th. "We deeply regret the scheduling error and the postseason for the team. We apologize to the players, coaches and families affected by this mistake, the school said in its statement. Mattoon schools are dedicated to offering many academic and extracurricular opportunities for our students. We strive to adhere to all state mandates and codes during implementation and scheduling of these programs. Procedures and policies related to scheduling are under review to ensure this does not happen again. Feith said Mattoon will not pursue any additional games to add to the schedule in place of postseason play. And continuing on the sports page from War Girls Basketball, a steal seals a win. Sullivan advances back to sectional finals. Esther Miller kept reading the eyes on defense and sagging off of her assignment. She knew a pass was coming and her time to jump into the lane would be there. Sure enough, with less than 10 seconds left in the third quarter on Monday in the Class 2A Tuscola sectional semifinals, her chance came. She burst into the lane, got the steal, and took it all the way for a layup on the other end with 2 seconds left in the third quarter. The play lit a fire in her team and capped off a massive third quarter. The Redskins kept pace in the fourth quarter and forced Albion Edwards County into every turnover imaginable on the way to a 65-43 win to advance to Thursday's sectional championship against Tutopolis. I think it gave us momentum going into the fourth quarter, and I think it helped us take it up another level, Miller said. Sullivan opened the fourth quarter on a 12-4 run to lead 52-38 with less than 4 minutes left. The momentum from Miller's steal carried over with ease, and the Redskins made life difficult for Edwards County to get shots up. The momentum was kind of shifted right there, Sullivan coach Sherry McCain said. She's been our catalyst all season. Being a senior, she knew what she needed to do. She got that steal, and the rest of the team followed. From there, she just kind of put them on her back. Miller finished with 14 points. Avery still had 19, and freshman Lily Null poured in 17 points for Sullivan, 26-3. After turning the ball over 14 times in the first half, Sullivan trailed 23-18, largely with Miller and Still on the bench in foul trouble. Miller was frustrated but not panicked while she watched from the bench. I was really frustrated, Miller said. I do not want to end my season sitting on the bench. I knew that we would make a comeback in the second half. I know my team. I know we weren't going to lose, and we weren't going to let ourselves lose. Though the steal and layup to beat the third quarter buzzer was a pivotal moment for the Redskins, Miller actually felt the tide turn before that. It took less than 2 minutes for Sullivan to wipe away a halftime deficit and take the lead in the third quarter behind a pair of baskets from Miller and a putback from Still. In that moment, with the lead in hand, Miller knew her team had it. I feel like we just kind of took over from there, Miller said. Sullivan completely flipped the script in the second half, forcing 26 Edwards County turnovers and outscored the Lions 47-20 after halftime. Sullivan had 14 first half turnovers and just 10 in the second half. Our philosophy has been all year, it's not how you start, it's how you finish, Sullivan coach Sherry McCain said. I knew if we could survive with Avery and Esther on the bench in the first half, I figured that being down by 5 points and our leading scorer Miller sitting there, that we had some hope. Without Miller and Still in the first half, Null stepped in, scoring 6 of her 17 before halftime. She knocked down all 9 of her free throw attempts in that game. Defensively, Josie Orris and Jared Goad stepped in to try to slow Edwards County Malia Schmittler, who had 16 points and 10 rebounds. The first half, we just let them speed us up, Miller said. We weren't playing our game at all, but we won. And now we'll be taking a short break and return with the second half of the Herald and Review for Tuesday, February 12th, 2019. Please stay tuned.